Welcome to Whiskey Cast, the Cask Strength podcast featuring news and interviews from the world of whiskey. I'm Mark Gillespie. We're live with an audience today in Victoria, British Columbia at the Victoria Whiskey Festival. I've got a panel of whiskey experts and even Jim Murray here with me, and we'll introduce them in just a few minutes, and we're going to talk about, for the next half hour or so, some of the issues and some of the things that we whiskey lovers face. First, though, I do want to take a quick look at some of the news. You're going to be hearing in the next few days, if you haven't already, about a new development at Maker's Mark. This is Profile 51, sort of hit the news earlier this week, and it will be more talked about in the next few days. Basically, Kevin Smith, the master distiller at Maker's Mark, and some of the other folks have been experimenting with a new version of Maker's. We have not seen that in quite some time. They used to have the gold wax version of Maker's that was out a few years ago. It's long since slipped by the wayside. Kevin has been doing the John Glazer experiment. If you are familiar with what Compass Box has been doing and did originally with the Spice Tree, where he mounted staves inside the casks and violated about half a dozen Scotch Whiskey Association regulations by doing so. What Kevin Smith has done is, with what's called Recipe 51, is take the maker's whiskey out of the barrels at its normal aging time, about 5 years, 9 months, then mount these new staves, toasted oak staves, inside the barrels, and then put the whiskey back in for about 7 to 8 months or so. And it's we don't know yet what the outcome of this is going to be, but it's the first time it's actually been disclosed in public that they are playing with a new recipe. And I'm going to get to taste it this week with Kevin in New York City, and we'll have more on this on an upcoming episode. Now, Andrew Gray from Brook Lowdy has joined us in the back of the room, and I'm going to ask Andrew to come up to the microphone, the audience mic, for just a second, because the other story I wanted to talk about real quickly was what Brook Lowdy is doing with what's called an anaerobic digester technology. Now, I know that you're not as well-versed on this as some of your colleagues, but basically what this is a way to take some of the draft and the byproduct of the distilling process and do something creative with it. Right, Andrew?
Yes, it is. We've been investigating for a number of years now, ever since we had the idea to build a second distillery. We've been looking at new different technologies. We started off, believe it or not, with a university I went to, University of Strathclyde, and working with them on a wave renewable energy project. And that's been reasonably successful, and it could be more successful, but we have to wait till we can raise more money to take it to the next stage. When we were looking at the developing Port Charlotte distillery, we investigated a variety of other green technologies, wood chip burners and so on and so forth. This one is a particular pet project of Mark Rainier, and the only reason I don't know about it is he didn't tell me. we have that lovely political relationship within our company. I know a wee bit about it, but not all of it. I know that he's working, as you say, within a tank, experimenting in using microorganisms to digest the pot ale to create a gas that then, in turn, will, through a generator, create electricity. And our first estimate is that it could be 80% of our requirements at Brook Lowdy. Now, if that is successful, and the trial will commence in about 3 months' time, then we'll have to spend more money, and we'll go to a second tank and a second reactor to take it beyond that. Now, whether any other distillery adopts this process or not, it's too early to say.
I know that others are doing it. We were talking about Maker's just a minute ago, and Maker's has been doing this for a little bit of time, where they use the anaerobic digester process to generate methane gas that they then pump back into their fuel supply for their steam, for their for the stills. So they actually replaced about 10% or so of their natural gas needs with this technology. And I'm assuming Brook Lowdy will try to at least do the same, if not more.
I would hope so. As I say, it's all down to the experiment. It's down to the cash flow, the budget resources we have at the time. It's a very good idea. Makes a lot of sense to us. It is the sort of concept that Brook Lowdy likes, and we'd love to develop it. But it will have to fall into place with a whole range of other requirements that we're planning to develop as well at Bricklandi. I hope we do it, and I hope Mark is proven correct. I hope it's a great idea. I think it is a great idea. That's all I can say. Watch this space.
Okay, thank you, Andrew. Once again, Andrew Gray from Bricklandi. Now, the other fun story came out of here last night. This is a three-day festival, and last night Jim Murray, sitting immediately next to my right, led us in an 18-whiskey head-to-head knockout tasting that ran for more than 4 hours.
And it was a short one.
It was a short one, but wanted to point out that these were some amazing whiskeys. You would have heard of almost every single one of the whiskeys that was in this competition. But the winner was extremely unusual, right, Jim? It was Penderyn.
It was Penderyn. And because of the fact we had to really wrap up fast because we're kind of over on our slot, you only had about 10 seconds to actually register the shock on people's faces. But it was real, and I personally was absolutely delighted because people don't often give the lesser brands a chance. You know, it's they don't have the marketing clout and the rest of it, and it's very, very hard for them to sort, if they're going to buy X number of whiskies, to go for something they've not really heard before. So it was a great opportunity for a whiskey that not many people have probably tried to actually steal the show and really pull the rug under some other whiskey's feet.
And what were some of the other whiskeys in this competition? I've got to admit, after 18, I sort of forgot some of them.
Well, there was all kinds of stuff, though. I mean, there was whiskies from, there was the Ardbeg. And oddly enough, Ardbeg was about the only whiskey that people actually recognized when they were because the whole thing's tasted blind.
I wonder why we couldn't recognize Ardbeg.
Well, I mean, people were kind of, you could hear them going, it's Ardbeg. Mind you, some people were going, oh, Lafroy, you know, but not everyone got it right. But Ardbeg was the only one that they really spotted because it was done blind. And what we did, it was like a cup competition where you have one whiskey placed against another whiskey. You taste them, no one knows what they are, and then people vote. And the score was taken, and the one that got the high score went through to the next round.
Now, the person immediately to Jim's right is my fellow Maltmaniac, Davin DeKergamo. And Davin was sitting next to me last night, and we were having a hard time discussing some of these whiskeys and telling them apart, right?
We really did. It was especially going so quickly through them, it was difficult sometimes. Whiskeys that you would recognize, when you compare them, whatever you tasted just before sometimes changed the way the profile of the whiskey or how it tasted. But I have to say they were all really good whiskeys. Yeah, we really enjoyed that.
And I want to bring in the rest of the panel now. Immediately to Davin's right, as we go sort of right to left across your computer screen for those of you listening at home, Stuart Nickerson, the managing director at Glenglassaugh Distillery. Ed Patrick, the president of Canada's Companions of the Quake Whiskey Appreciation Society. And Dan Tullio, the heritage ambassador and director for Canadian Club Whiskey. And while we've got you guys here, one of the things I wanted to talk about real quickly, the Canadian whiskeys made a very interesting showing last night, as we were talking about before we started recording here. And I would like to sort of address and to be politically correct here, the amount of an inferiority complex when it comes to Canadian whiskeys among Canadians, because you make some wonderful whiskeys in Canada, but when you come down to try to drink them, they tend to, if you, for instance, we talked about Alberta Premium, and Alberta Premium is one of these really great rye whiskeys, but when you ask about it in Canada, it's, huh? For the most part.
It's not just, huh? It's actually sold in plastic bottles, some of it. I mean, that's the kind of standing that it holds.
And I want to find out why we have this, why is there this complex about what is really an outstanding whiskey market and an outstanding whiskey in body in Canadian whiskey. Why do we have such an inferiority complex about it here in Canada? Anybody who just wants to jump in can go right ahead here. I'm not going to call out names. Dan, why don't you start us off?
Well, Mark, that's a good question. At the end of the day, it seems as if Canadian whiskies have become a commodity-priced, item. And, going through any liquor store across any province across Canada, there's, there's a huge array of different brands that one can purchase in the Canadian whiskey category. And maybe, shame on us that, we didn't, over the last 10, 20 years didn't really try to increase the profile of Canadian whiskey. And there's a plethora of brands out there. The price difference between a 3-year-old, a 6-year-old, a 10-year-old, a 12-year-old, I mean, they're all about $1.50 apart. And we weren't as, let's say, on top of it as our Scottish friends over here with their whiskeys that made it very, approachable and premium.
From the consumer point, I'd like to get Davin and Ed to address this too, because you guys live here in Canada and you deal with this on a regular basis. Ed, why don't you start off?
Well, it's true, Mark. The rectitude by Canadians about their own whiskey is directly related to the fact that we Canadians apologize for everything. When Canadian tourists go over to Glasgow and they're out on a Friday night and they get mugged by University of Strathclyde students who are drunk, it's the Canadian who apologizes for being mugged. We've got a good single malt distillery down in Cape Breton, and you wouldn't know it. You wouldn't know it. Canadians don't talk about it. Canadians don't promote it. They make a damn fine little dram down there. Unfortunately, there's another company of bottlers in Canada who bring over single malt scotch by the barrel. And unfortunately, they can't bottle it in Ontario. They have to add 1% of Canadian content, and it's the 1% of the Glen Breton. It doesn't make the slightest damn bit of difference to the whiskey, but again, people look down their noses at it. See, this isn't single malt scotch. This is mixed with some stuff from Canada. Very bad. You Canadians will have to sharpen up.
Davin?
Well, I agree with you, Mark. We make some very, very good whiskeys here in Canada. A lot of them don't get exported to other countries, and people don't get to taste them. But we also make a lot of whiskey that's exported in bulk and really packaged to be put into mixed drinks. And frankly, I think, the Scottish have done a really good job on selling the business that the whiskey has to be made, a certain way from three materials only, water and yeast and malted barley. Of course, they add a lot of wine now. They just do it a different way. They soak it out of the barrel.
And
caramel as well. But Alberta Premium is a whiskey that, honestly, the only problem with that whiskey is it's underpriced. If you added $20 to the price, people would be lining up to buy it. It's really fantastic. And another terrific whiskey is the Canadian Club 20-year-old. That's honestly one of my favorite whiskeys. It is the wood in it is just so beautiful. Talk about Weiser's 18-year-old. My goodness, where are you going to find a nicer whiskey than that from any country? But in terms of the inferiority complex, yes, Canadians, I think, always look across the border. Take 40 Creek, which is putting out a whiskey that's really popular now. Where did that whiskey become popular first? In Texas. That's a whiskey that had to make its mark in the United States before the Canadians would start buying it. And I'd like to say a thing about the plastic bottles. At a certain volume, LCBO requires that we use plastic, and that is an environmental matter. It's not a choice on the part of the distiller, and it's not done to because we don't think enough of our whiskey. It's just that once that we reach a certain volume, and LCBO is the biggest purchaser of whiskey, and their biggest volume, incidentally, is Canadian whiskey. We're really, we drink our whiskey. We just don't talk a lot about it. We're, kind of self-deprecating people and a little bit shy.
Dan, what do you think has to be done to improve the image? Since that's your specialty with the Canadian Club, mm-hmm. What has to be done to improve the image of Canadian whiskeys worldwide?
My personal opinion is that if we came up with new marks within our portfolio to give us something to talk about. I mean, most recently we came up with CC Sherry Cask, and unfortunately in a number of different provinces it didn't do well because it didn't have the turn on the shelf. And, of course, in a controlled government environment you get kicked off. But You know, if we came up with a Canadian whiskey, a Canadian club, let's say that's you know, quarter cask, it might cause some talk action, or you know, perhaps a product that is aged in apple wood, something different, something unique. The tannins in Canadian whiskey do coincide with other types of wood, so to come up with a product that is unique, a key point of differentiation, will hopefully help to elevate the profile of our brines.
And this is probably the longest this weekend that Jim Murray has gone without saying a word. So, Jim?
Oh, but I've been thinking a lot. I mean, let's go back to Alberta Premium. 4 or 5 years ago, I gave it Canadian Whiskey of the Year, and absolutely deservedly so. And I went on TV, and I absolutely shocked people. I went on, you know, live broadcasts, and people tasted, and they said, no, this can't be possibly Alberta Premium. They were absolutely taken aback.
This was the 25-year-old version.
No, this is the standard one. The Alberta 25 then didn't exist. So what happens? Alberta says, well, actually, we've got some old stocks. We're going to bring out a 25-year-old. Great, fantastic. What price do they bring it out at? $25. What is that about? What kind of statement is that making about their own whiskey? And as far as the LCBO is concerned, saying, oh, we put it into plastic bottles, stuff the LCBO. The industry should say, no, we're not going to put it into plastic bottles because you're making us look cheap, you're making us look inferior, you're doing your own industry down. And they should be fighting that. Why is there, you know, an industry association and they're not fighting that? So that isn't an excuse. So I'm coming back in about 6 weeks to 2 months' time. I'll be back at the Empress Hotel tasting every Canadian whiskey that there is in the marketplace. And do you know something? I am so looking forward to it because there is fantastic whiskey here. And I'm one of the few people who ever discovers that.
Mark? Go ahead. Andrew, come on back up to the microphone.
Just on that subject, I used to be at Bowmore and then left Bowmore and set up my own company, Liquid Gold, before coming to Brooklandy. At Liquid Gold, we bottled a product called Canadian Heritage. And this was Canadian whiskey that we bought from Highwood Distillers, which I believe they sold as Century Reserve or something like that, a 21-year-old. Now, they're sold at something like $39. We put it into a decanter from Saverglass. It was the same whiskey, and we sold it at something like $120. And it got into the top 50 spirits, Paul Peckle's top 50 spirits of that year. The whiskey quality was superb. And there was nothing wrong with Century Reserve's whiskey. It was the same whiskey.
Right.
It was looked at in a completely different context, being in a very fancy decanter.
And if anybody else in the audience has a question or wants to weigh in on this, please just feel free to come up to the microphone up here, and we'll stop for a second and let you get your comments in, too, on this. Stuart, I want to bring you into this because Jim has mentioned and Davin has mentioned what may be one of the biggest four-letter words in the whiskey industry, the LCBO, which for those of us who aren't familiar with Canadian politics is the Liquor Control Board of Ontario, which... for better or worse, tends to set a lot of policy. You're bringing in your Glenglassaugh whiskeys now. What experiences have you had in dealing with the Canadian market where you have a mix of a lot of control provinces, some that are hybrids like here in British Columbia, and Alberta, which we all appreciate for being semi-completely autonomous and free. What differences and difficulties have you had in trying to get your product into Canada?
Well, the first province we actually tried to get into was Ontario, and that was over 12 months ago, and we're still waiting to be listed there. That gives tremendous problems. We get feedback saying we don't want another Scotch whiskey. We have too many Scotch whiskies. We then found a very good importer in Purple Valley who are based in Alberta, and to be honest, that has been reasonably straightforward, I'll be honest. I think Alberta works well. As long as we do the labelling correctly, get all the extra triplicates and quadruplets of our documents prepared correctly, and we get it in. But it's certainly not as simple as Europe. And BC, without a doubt, is yet another step. Our products came in just before Christmas into Alberta and BC. They're on the shelves in Alberta, and they're still waiting. They've been held up in BC. Nothing to do with it. It's the time it takes for the process to go ahead. And then you have to try and cherry-pick the other provinces on top of that.
And in dealing with the LCBO, I've learned from past experience that they only add whiskeys to their calendar, to their schedule, once a year, if I'm correct on this, guys. Ed, Devin, you may have some more experience with this, and Dan. They only add a whiskey once a year. And if you don't make their time frame, you're screwed, essentially, right?
That's right. I mean, our only potential way into Ontario now is in the duty-free area, which is something we're looking at. But actually, it's going to Ontario. Yeah.
And Andrew's coming back up. Go ahead.
That's not strictly true. They have different categories. So they have vintages, they have spirits, and they have other categories. So there may be once a year for each category, but between all the categories they have, it's probably about four times a year that you have a chance to get a whiskey listed.
Let's switch over to another topic now. One of the things that a lot of folks have complained about over the last couple of years, 6 months to a year, is, for lack of a better term, the premiumization of whiskey in general. I got an email, and I referred to this on the last episode, from a young whiskey drinker in the Netherlands who's 19 years old, legal age there, and is serious about becoming a whiskey connoisseur. He's visited distilleries, he's doing the tastings, and he's doing everything he can to learn about whiskey. But what he faces is the prospect that when he reaches our age, for lack of a better term, that whiskey may not be affordable for the average person anymore, because we see so many distilleries coming out with these $10,000-$15,000 whiskeys, and that's all we ever seem to focus on is the high end of the market, and are we ignoring the low end of the market and ignoring new whiskey drinkers when we come out with all these premium expressions? And anybody that wants to jump in can go ahead here.
Who's we?
Anyone on the panel?
No, no, no. Who is we who is ignoring the whiskeys?
Those of us, okay, I will not exclude you because you cover them all, but I will admit to having a certain, when I'm going through news releases and stuff and looking for stories to report on, the latest 50-year-old bottling from certain distilleries that shall not be named here, yeah, tends to get into the show occasionally. But when somebody comes out with a new 10-year-old expression, if I don't find out about it, it doesn't make the show, because it's a basic, what might be called a commodity-level bottling coming out into the marketplace, but it's the kind of it's for the lack of attention that whiskey enthusiasts don't get.
Mark,
they don't hear about it.
Mark, he will not have a problem, and the reason he will not have a problem is because distilleries have to make money. They can only make money if they sell their product. If they overprice the product, they can't sell it. If they can't sell it, they go out of business. So there will always be a level, be it blended whiskey. And why not blended whiskey? Many blended whiskeys, not seven bells out of single malts. I mean, there's whiskeys at every price level. I mean, in the UK at the moment, they're talking about upping the price of alcohol in general because of the fact that there's, you know, major drinking problems there. But I cannot even begin to believe that this guy will have a problem when he reaches our age of about 25. And I just don't think it can happen.
I agree and disagree with Jim, in that I'm older than 25, Jim, but I agree. We're all commercial companies. We have to make money. We have to have positive cash flow. So for these points of view, then there will always be affordable whiskies out there. Affordable meaning that we can sell our products. Obviously, there has to become a time where you can't make them too affordable and that you're making a loss, etc. But you have to have affordable products. But there'll also be premium products where there's been extra cost, extra effort, they're special quality, and they cost more.
Is it fair to say that those premium products attract attention to the lower priced products in a range?
I think they do. I think the premium products often are just out there, possibly even help marketing as well as much as anything.
They could always come to Canada and drink Alberta Premium. For
They're publicity stunts in some cases, I think. Honestly, some of these really outrageously expensive whiskeys, they'll gather dust for years in the liquor stores, but everybody's talking about them, and it attracts attention to that particular brand. But there are mainline whiskeys that are really good. Look at Lagavulin 16, which only gets better year after year. Fantastic whiskey. It's a little bit more expensive now, but I mean, that's still an affordable whiskey. I think the real problem we have with Scotch whiskey is the homogenization of flavors. I remember in the Malt Maniacs Awards a couple of years ago, we had, I think, 40 whiskeys that all tasted essentially the same coming from distilleries all over Scotland. I think that's where the real problem is. But they're going to sell every drop of whiskey they can distill, and the market will set the price.
Ed? You were leaning in, Ed?
No, not on that subject.
Well, you were telling us earlier in your master class that your first bottle of whiskey you paid $2.50 for.
No, I paid $5
for it. Oh, $5
for it. That's why I was complaining. It cost double what a regular bottle of scotch cost at that time in 1959.
So we were talking about premiumization 50 years ago.
Yeah, and my only regret in life was that I didn't buy more when it was cheaper. Then I came to Canada, and I got gouged by the LCBO. And I didn't want to say, Mark, there is great hope that the LCBO will be privatized shortly. Because the government of Ontario, which refused to privatize it previously, now finds itself in a $2.75 billion hole. And if they privatize the LCBO, they'll get their money back. The suppliers all over the world will be happy. The retailers in Ontario will be delighted. And the consumers will be ecstatic. Because the same thing will happen there. We'll see prices plummeting by at least 25%. We're paying 40% more for the same bottle of whiskey in Ontario as you can buy in Alberta, 40% less. That's scandalous. We don't even have free trade in Canada. Cheaper whiskey.
Less tax.
Yeah, is that really the problem, is that it's not the cost of whiskey that's rising, but it's the taxes?
Taxes. Upon taxes.
Because that's affecting us jurisdictionally all over the world, is that governments have now seen that they can raise money on the basis of so-called sin taxes. And they did it to tobacco, and now they're coming after whiskey in a lot of ways. How much, Dan, maybe, I don't know if you can answer this or not, but realistically, how much of the cost of a bottle of CC on average would go to taxes?
Well, for example, in the province of Ontario, I believe that we're taxed at 86%. So the selling price of one of our, $7.50 of Canadian Club is sitting on the shelf at $24. We manufacture, blend, age, and bottle, advertise, promote, pay guys like us, and we sell it to our only customer in that province for about $3.25. But on the shelf, it's sitting at around $24. And we make money on that $3.25 a bottle.
Barely, right?
Mm-hmm.
Scandalous.
So
we see this problem in other countries, too. And is there a point at which the tax structure kills whiskey connoisseurship, or because the taxes make it impossible for us to be able to get a decent dram at a reasonable price?
Well, there's a kind of a weird one here, isn't there? Because if it's too cheap, then people start drinking a lot of it, or alcohol in general. They then end up in hospital with all kinds of kidney damage. Then, say in Britain, huge amounts of money that was taken from the taxes on the whiskey and other alcohols are ploughed back in to keep these people alive, and they have to find more money on top. So the whole tax thing is a complete utter mess. Don't know. The point is that different countries have different levels of taxation. I mean, we're going back to the guy in Holland again. In Europe, there's no problem him travelling around and finding somewhere that's cheaper than somewhere else, because the tax levels are always different.
I should note that Ed has had to leave us to go off to another master class. Jim has to do the same. Thank you for joining us, Jim.
You're welcome.
And Andrew has now joined us up here on the podium. So let's talk a little bit more about Scotch whiskies now. Stuart and Andrew, you both have to deal with this whole issue of minimum pricing in your home markets now that is coming up not only within Scotland but also within the UK in general. How is this really going to affect whiskey drinkers?
I think it's a very contentious issue, the impact of minimum pricing right across the board. There are many benefits people can see as to make sure that alcohol is affordable, but on the other hand, not to make it too affordable. I think the biggest impact is going to be on, the blended products, and I can see it driving people into some of the other products that are out there at the moment. It's going to have less of an impact on the older aged products.
Andrew?
I personally think the concept is a good one. In Scotland, we have a problem. There's no question about it, a drinking problem. And it has to be addressed. And it hasn't been addressed, and it's getting worse. It's not getting better. Now, I personally wouldn't. I would recommend some kind of development and change to the policy they have in place just now, or the concept, rather, the proposal, rather, they're putting forward. The drinks that the younger people of a certain age group are drinking, it's not really blended whiskey. It's certainly not single malt whiskey. It might be an alcopop. It might be a strong lager or whatever. So I think the concept of increasing the price of the drinks that they are interested in drinking is a good one. And I think it has to be done until such time as there is a behavioral change and an attitude change. If it happens, we have to. I think our industry has to live with it. Scotland is a great country. I travel 6 months of the year. I've been to hundreds and hundreds of countries. Scotland's a great country, and anything we can do to change what's happening in Scotland, to me, is a good idea.
I want to wind this down now. Davin is here sort of as the representative of the consumer and of the whiskey connoisseur. You mentioned earlier that judging in the Malt Maniacs Awards, there were a bunch of whiskeys that tasted all the same, pretty much. What do we do to get past that and to get to the point where we start getting whiskeys that express their distillery characters more fluently and with more passion and get back to those original distillery characteristics again? Where do we go on this? Is this something that the consumers have to push the distillers on? Is this something that we have to have the distillers? Is it an education issue? Where do we go from here on this?
Well, I think to some degree, Scotch whiskey is a bit of a victim of its own success. You can pretty well sell anything they make. I think if we really want to make good Scotch whiskey, we need to get the accountants to stop making decisions about whiskey and let the distillers make decisions. Let the blenders. Because so much of this is just the decision is based on the bottom line, and they can sell anything. But look at the new Glendronics. Those whiskeys are fantastic. They're way better than the whiskeys that were coming out when it was a great big company. I think that the problem here is we're too worried about the bottom line at a time when we can really make a lot of money selling whiskey, because anything can be sold, and the Asian market's opening up like crazy. I mean, look at Macallan bringing out those fine oaks. They just gutted Macallan with that, and yet they sell it hand over fist, and they've been promoting it enough that now people who are new to whiskey are starting to talk about how good this stuff is. Man, that is nothing like what Macallan used to be. And I think that the real problem is that we have too many people making decisions based on squeezing every last cent out of an ounce of whiskey, and not enough decisions about let's make a whiskey that we can be proud of and that people are going to still want to still be talking about 10 years from now.
And Stuart jumped forward towards the microphone because I know you're working for a small company that's owned by a larger company in Skagit, but which owns Glenglassaugh now.
Really, we're a small company. We have a group of investors.
Okay.
We don't really take any responsibility in that.
So it's not like you're reporting to corporate bean counters somewhere?
No, not at all. Not at all. We are very much seen as an independent company, and they have the financial support, but not to the extent that we're talking about there. I think it is very important to let the distillers, and that's what I count myself as, make lots of decisions. However, the consumers all over the world, many consumers, still want to see a consistent product no matter where they are in the world. And that's what these larger companies are managing to do by making things, to a certain extent, blander but more consistent and more homogenous across the world. And that's where the very large, the people that are selling tens and hundreds of thousands of cases of single malts are trying to do, make a consistent product. For the likes of ourselves, we're trying to get back to something that is extremely stylistic, exactly what you would expect of Glenglassaugh if you'd bought it 60 or 70 years ago.
Andrew?
I think it's a balance. I think Scotch whiskey has, over the years, has become a huge industry, and therefore it needs to be run under certain commercial conditions. We're fortunate at Brooklady. We have sufficient funds to be able to buy great casks, and it's not about the bottom line in everything that we do. We're all for experimentation and trying different things, and some people like it, some people don't. But it's never a question of finance at the end of the day that it controls our policy in terms of buying wood or in terms of the amount that we produce or whatever and what styles we produce. So, I think it's a balance. I think our industry has many things that it can be proud of, and the range of whiskies we have, which is growing all the time, I think it's a good thing. If the wine industry didn't develop into different countries and all the different wine bottlings you have, would it be as popular a category as it is? I like choice. Whiskey is a mood drink. For every hour of the day, every day of the week, to me, there's a whiskey that suits that mood. So bring it on. The more, the better, as far as I'm concerned.
Let's end this with a fun question, and I want to start with Dan on this. If you could produce any kind of whiskey at your facilities that you're not producing now, what would you produce? What flavor profile would it have if you could start from a clean sheet of paper with a CC formula? What would it taste like if you had your choice?
Well, you know, we profess to be the original Canadian distiller, and you know, there aren't that many things that are truly Canadian. I mean, we've got our flag, we've got Roots clothing, we've got Canadian Club. I would like to see something that probably has a taste profile that really brings Canada forward. Probably a brand that has got more of a rye content in it, you know, sweeter tones. Product that's more flavorful, a lot of caramel and butterscotch. You know, and then my Scottish friends sitting next to me over here, I mean, maybe put something in a quarter cask from Scotland and see how that Canadian whiskey is going to taste, you know, since there's such a strong following for Scotch whiskey. But, yeah, just to reignite it, to bring it to the next level, something more of Canadiana.
Andrew? Although you guys already pretty much produce anything you want at Brooklady now.
Well, I agree everything that's been said there. I think Canadian rye whiskey is just sensational. So we would be interested in taking some Canadian rye quarter cask, maturing it. We try to, until we were stopped by the Scotch Whiskey Association, we try to introduce a vatting of Brooklady whiskey with Canadian single malt whiskey. We'd started already with a product called Celtic Nations with Brooklady and Cooley peated Connemara, and until we found out that it was illegal to bring in whiskey outside of Scotland and vat with Scotch whiskey. But the next one that we were going to visit, it was going all around the world, this series, the next one was going to Glenbretton. And we were going to mix it with that whiskey, and then we were going to America with Evan Williams and so on and so forth. It was celebrating the Celts' influence in setting up distilling around the world. And it's a great shame that we can't do that, but the next best thing would be just is what you suggested, is using some Canadian rye cask to mature whiskey in. I think that's a great idea. And I think you're absolutely right about Canadian rye. I think Canadian rye whiskey is fantastic. It can be sold at higher prices. There is a market for it. And you do have some older ages, and there's now beginning to become a scarcity in older ages of Scotch whiskey. I think you guys can step in there.
Stuart, you're getting pretty much a chance to start from the clean sheet now with Glenglassaugh.
Well, that's what I was going to say. We only produce new make spirit, obviously, Glenglassaugh just now. The oldest stuff is only just over 12 months old. So what I ideally would like to produce is our award-winning, trophy-winning 30- and 40-year-olds in 7 or 8 years. That's ideally what I'd like to do.
We'll get you a time machine if we can figure out the technology for that one. Devin, what would you like to see these guys produce?
Well, you know, I'm kind of with Dan on that one. I think we need a whiskey that's really got a lot of rye flavoring, got those spices, got that hardness, and I'd like to see some nice wood in it, like first fill bourbons. You remember Lot 40? How could you beat that whiskey? Just a fantastic whiskey. Again, sort of sadly underpriced, so it didn't take off. But yeah, I'd like to see a whiskey with a lot of rye. I think rye is where it's going, and I'm not convinced that American rye is where it's going. I think that Canadian rye really, that's what I'd like to see. That's what I'd like to taste.
And I'd like to thank the panel for helping us out with this show. Devin DeCargamo from the Malt Maniacs, Stuart Nickerson of Glenglassaugh, Andrew Gray of Brooklady, Dan Tullio of Canadian Club, along with Jim Murray and Ed Patrick, who had to leave us earlier. Guys, thank you for doing this. I really appreciate it. It's been a lot of fun, and I'm sorry I put you on the spot on a few questions, but it's been an interesting chance. I hope the folks who were able to stick around before the next round of masterclasses started and had to leave were able to get something out of it. I hope everyone learned something from this. So thank you, guys.
You're very welcome. Thank you very much, Mark. Thanks, everybody.
Thank you,
guys.
And let's continue now with the calendar of events brought to you by Laphroaig. Just a few quick notes to wind things down. Now, McTeers will hold its next auction of rare whiskeys on the 3rd of February in Glasgow. Martin Duffy will host a Johnny Walker tasting dinner at Morton's in Chicago on February 5th. Whiskey Live Tokyo is February 21st. John Hansel of Malt Advocate will do a tasting at Monk's in Philadelphia, one of my favorite local bars, on March 2nd, and those sell out quickly, so you will have to rush to get tickets for that. And tickets are also on sale now for the next big event here in Canada, the Spirit of Toronto Festival, on April 24th. I do have a lot of people I want to thank in addition to our panel, the Victoria Whiskey Festival Committee, led by Lawrence Graham, my friends at Star Global, Carolyn Yardley, and Graham Knott, who handled all the website work to try to get our live webcast up, and apologies for not being able to make that work out. I also want to thank the guys at Stream On in Edmonton, who were providing the bandwidth and the equipment to do the live webcast today, and we will do this again at a point in the future. And here at the Hotel Grand Pacific, I want to thank Luke Davison and Gary Kynes from the Facilities, AV, and IT Department for all their hard work setting everything up now. Once again, you're listening to Whiskey Cast, a production of Cask Strength Media, copyright 2010, normally coming to you from the charming yet regrettably dry town of Haddonfield, New Jersey, coming to you this weekend from the Victoria Whiskey Festival in beautiful Victoria, British Columbia. I'm Mark Gillespie, reminding you that when you drink, please drink responsibly, and thanks for listening.